The Guardian.
Hello, I'm Alexis Petridis, and you are listening to Music Weekly. In today's podcast, we have some of this from Germany. As we place a call to electronic music pioneers Compact, plus we have a little of this from the Go team.
Yeah.
But with African, it's a lot flatter, it's a lot more kind of direct.
And of course, we have our regular singles club. This week, we will be performing an autopsy on new tracks from Adele, The Decemberists, and Brother. First, let me welcome our guests. We have The Guardian's film and music editor, Michael Hann, with us. Hello.
Hello, Alexis.
How are you doing? Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you as well.
Excellent. we're also joined by our writer and critic, Jude Rogers. Hello, Jude.
Hello, Alexis.
Happy New Year to you.
Happy New Year to you as well.
Did you have an exciting Christmas?
I did. You know, sort of exciting.
Would you like to...
Family came over.
Oh, right, okay.
All of Wales came to London. It was very exciting.
Did it really? Wow, must have been incredible. What about you, Michael? Did anything good? See any good gigs over Christmas?
There weren't a lot to go to, were there? The highlight of Christmas was that I gave my sister, as a present, framed something I'd obtained for her. Her name's Rosalind. And I got Bruce Springsteen to sign an autograph for her to Rosalinda, Come Out Tonight. She's a big Springsteen fan.
Wow, that's
amazing.
She
literally sat there staring at it for about an hour and a half.
Wow, that's just, it's a beautiful story.
It is.
It's a beautiful story.
It's how Bruce Springsteen can bring people together.
Absolutely, absolutely amazing. I didn't get anything like that for Christmas. Right, anyway, time for some girl shouting, trumpet squealing, double Dutch blaxploitation from the irrepressible Go team. Their third album, Rolling Blackouts, is out later this month, and I met up with band leader Ian Parton in Brighton and found him, well, caught somewhere between the epic and the lo-fi. The last time we spoke about the Go team, you were talking, and I don't think you were talking facetiously, about not even making a second album. You were saying, you know, you sort of felt maybe you just go back to sort of working in film, which was the job you did before.
Yeah.
What changed? What kind of convinced you to keep going?
why are you bothering? No, it was a general... I don't think it was a genuine, because, you know, the Mannix thing, wasn't it? You know, we're gonna finish after the first album and all that, you know. It wasn't like a statement like that. It was just a general fear of dad rock and looking too old to be on a stage, really. So maybe I've reached that point. I don't know, maybe I should get like a facelift or something, like the whole band. But
And what sort of convinced you that it was all right to carry on? What made you think, well, you know, man, I'm not too old for this? Or?
I think it was generally, I'm always sort of frustrated with never being able to quite nail this perfect idea I had of the kind of this kind of schizo hybrid kind of song, you know what I mean? So,
I mean, when the Go team first started, you arrived, as a lot of bands do now, with a very sort of keenly defined aesthetic, you know. And one of the things about doing that, I always feel, is if you arrive with a keenly defined aesthetic, it's quite hard to develop from it if everything's sort of in place, you know what I mean? And yet this album, you seem to have brought kind of a lot of different influences to it. It does sound noticeably different.
I definitely wanted there to be more melody and more singing, because I think that's a lot harder than just sort of rapping over the top of a sample, do you know what I mean? I think it's... I'm trying to make this kind of a warped little pop song, basically, all the time, but have this kind of barrier around it that tells you that it's not for the hit parade, you know what I mean? I think it is different. I think every album's been different. I think this one is... There's more kind of width to it. I think it feels a bit more kind of panoramic, a bit more sort of Morricone, desert-esque in places, you know what I mean? A bit more widescreen.
Tell me a little bit about the people that you work with on it, because you've got some sort of guest vocalists and stuff like that on there. Tell me about them.
Well, I guess the highest profile one, although she wasn't when I when I recorded with her, was Bethany from Best Coast. You know, this was about 2009, December. So this is pre-Best Coast hype, you know, and then there's, you know, Satomi from Deerhoof, who's like a Go team favourite, really, you know. I'd written this song called Secretary Song, which was very kind of 60s Tokyo office. It was very, I was thinking, you know, like people typing in time and kind of symmetrical offices and someone who hated their job, and it had this melody in the chorus, which is quite Dear Hoofy. You know. Another one features African gospel choir, and I went down to where they practice in Streatham with my computer and some microphones, and
right.
and we did it just in one night. Really cool, you know, again, wanting to get that kind of Morricone sound. But I didn't want to use, like, a British gospel choir or an American one because they would have kind of over...
Yeah.
But with African, it's a lot flatter. It's a lot... It's a lot more kind of direct.
Yeah. You had at one point a sort of dalliance with a major label. Mm. Did that end rather badly? I mean, how did that go?
Not particularly, no. I mean, it was only for the one album, and which is how we wanted it, you know. It was a real... It was a one-album deal, but we kept annoying them, basically, by refusing to do adverts for the album. Hey, you know...
Oh, right, that kind of thing,
yeah,
right, yeah.
Get Thunder Lightning Strike now in shops, you know, and we just said, no, we don't want that.
Weren't they also pissed off that you wouldn't do, you wouldn't sort of license your songs to be used on adverts and stuff like that as well?
They never said that.
I bet they were.
They probably, yeah. I mean, it was the concept of not doing it would be alien to them, I'd have thought. You know, it'd be like a marketing opportunity, basically. Mm. So they probably would have been pissed off, yeah. But they never exerted pressure in that way.
Didn't somebody do, was it like I can't remember if it was an advert for Muller Rice or something like that, and I heard on the soundtrack that somebody had clearly done, you know, had sat down, sort of session musicians or whatever, and made a Go Team-like track.
I'm aware of countless examples of that.
How does that make you feel?
I don't know, it's a funny one, isn't it? It's like you say, it's the kind of the curse of the aesthetic thing that you've nailed, you know what I mean? It must be like Moon Safari, how Air felt. You know, when they kept seeing their things on their sort of takeoff of their things on like makeover shows and stuff like that. That's one of the reasons why I'm quite funny about adverts, is because when you're making happy music, which I don't even like calling it that, but when it becomes hijacked by a brand, then it ruins the whole thing. Do you know what I mean? It's like I had this request the other day from Gala Bingo to use a song as like a little intro to Emmerdale, you know, when it's sponsored by Gala.
Oh, like the sort of interstitial advert thing, yeah.
And that was just a glimpse into hell, do you know what I mean? It was like, it was, whoa.
The title track sounds like a bit of a homage to My Bloody Valentine. Would that be fair to say?
Kinda, yeah. I always thought of it as being a bit like Some Velvet Morning or something as well, though. It's kind of got this panoramic kind of widescreen kind of feel to it, like a desert, like you're driving through a desert or something like that.
This sort of, you've mentioned this quite a lot in the interview, this sort of desert Morricone kind of thing. Does that come from touring? Is that where did the sort of desire to make music like that come from? Or is it just the experience of listening to music like that and thinking?
Yeah, I mean, when I first started, I was making kind of like pretend spaghetti western music, you know, like proper...
Oh, really?
Yeah. With me, like, doing the vocals as well sometimes, you know. I'm really always torn between kind of epicness and lo-fi-ness. I love both things at the same time. And because this record, the very last thing we did with it was put it onto cassette, the whole thing. Like, so we mixed thousands of pounds on the record, and then you just put it onto a cassette. So that's what we took to the mastering place. It's got like that surface noise thing at the beginning of the song as well, which always makes me feel better, you know. It's part of it psychological in a way. Yeah, I've always wanted to take the edge off things. I always want it to have that kind of slight griminess to it, you know. Simultaneously, I'm getting pulled in two directions. I want it at times to be epic, and we actually use like a 15-piece brass band, you know, for that kind of parade, ticker tape, all that kind of thing, as if it's a field recording in a street. But then at the end of the day, we, you know, put it onto a cassette, so it's kind of two things going on at the same time, you know.
That was Ian Parton of the Go Team. Their album Rolling Blackouts is released at the end of the month. Jude, are you a fan of the Go Team?
I haven't heard this album yet. I did really, really love the first album. I really loved it because it did sound very different and very joyous, and the way that he was talking about it being happy music, it did seem that it was extremely happy and innocent and naive, and it was quite refreshing at the time, I remember. But a lot of the subsequent stuff of theirs has been a bit samey, I think.
Yeah, I agree.
Although, kind of, the snippets I heard there, quite interested to hear a bit more of them.
I think it's
It was very My Bloody Valentine, wasn't it?
I thought it sounded exactly like My Bloody Valentine myself. But, no, I think that's what's good about this album, actually. I thought with the second album, there was a sense of diminishing returns had set in a little bit. And the best track on that was a track I thought called Our World, which was just a cover of, like, a piece of library music from an old science programme or something like that. Whereas this album, I was really pleasantly surprised by. I really like the song-based stuff on it. I think they're quite good songwriters. And it sort of ended up being weirdly kind of the moment because it's got Best Coast on it. It's got a sort of chill
I think there's also a sense that they've been away long enough now that the familiar stuff feels fresh again in a way that it didn't with the second album. With the second album, we've heard this before, but, you know, in the intervening time, there hasn't actually been a ton of music that sounds much like this, so it does sound fresh again. Although, whenever I hear the Go Team, I do find myself thinking they're the indie low fidelity all-stars.
And that might be wrong. The low fidelity all-stars were the indie low fidelity all-stars,
weren't they? Well, they weren't really, were they? Alex is getting all nostalgic for Big Beat.
I saw the Low Fidelity All-Stars upstairs at the garage. No one cares about it. I'm not even going to embark on this story. It's such a rubber. It's not like, you know, I saw Nirvana. I saw the Velvet Underground with Andy Warhol doing the light. I saw the Low Fidelity, but it was on the night of the 1997 election. There you go.
Tell us about the time you saw Mega City 4 downstairs. Amazing. At the 12.
It's funny you say that they haven't done any adverts, because I would have assumed that they'd done lots of adverts because of the sound of their music seems to have just been absolutely ubiquitous.
No, they're very seriously, he has very serious kind of indie ethics. And won't license any of their music to adverts, and also wouldn't do any advertising.
There's indie, and then there's two indies.
There's Nose, Face, and Spite.
I mean, it's an interesting thing. I think it's a really interesting angle to take for somebody like him, because, you know, obviously they could have made quite a lot of money from sinking rights, as it's known.
Yes.
But they prefer not to, which is, you know, that's good. So Bill Hicksy kind of thing. I think that's pretty cool. Right, well, that's the Go Team. Their third album, Rolling Blackouts, out at the end of the month. I really like it. Go and get it. Check it out. Okay, time for Singles Club now. As usual, we've all selected... God, I'm really stumbling over my words today.
It's like Bobby Gillespie recording Sonic Flower Groove, isn't it?
Yeah, you're going to
have it done a syllable at a time.
As usual, we've all selected a track to discuss and generally give a right good listening to. Let's start off with Michael's choice.
How I lived a childhood in snow, and all my teens in tow, stuffed in strata of glow. Pale the winter days after dark, wandering the grey memorial park, a fleeting beating of hearts. What were the words I meant to say before she left, when I could see her breath lead where she was going?
And you said, what about breakfast at Tiffany's? That's what it sounds like.
I'm leaving.
No, I am a big fan of the band we heard there. It isn't Breakfast at Tiffany's by Deep Blue something, is it?
No, it's not.
What is it, Michael?
It's January Hymn by the Decembrists. This song, it was kind of a blessed relief for me. Last time the Decembrists were in this country and they were touring the Hazards of Love, and that this odd show with the entire Hazards of Love album in the first half,
which was a sort of rock opera,
which I thought was a failure, I've got to say. Bookish Americans approaching middle age with spectacles and pot bellies don't make convincing prog metal monsters. No. And that's what Decembrists were trying to do.
No, I agree.
But they did, they debuted this song, January Hymn, as an encore. It just seemed, hey, maybe there Colin Molloy is going to go back to writing songs, because I think he has an amazing melodic gift. And it's almost as if he was so talented, he thought, I'm going to ignore this facility I have for writing great songs. I'm going to do something epic.
Mm.
And curiously, we've got an interview with the Decemberists, with Colin Molloy in Film and Music this week. And he says more or less these things, you know, that we went too far. We did something that we couldn't keep building on. And they've retreated back almost to the start of their career and then headed off in the other direction that was open to them, which was melodic.
Deep Blue Something.
I'm not going to say Deep Blue Something, but kind of melodic pop again. I think this is a really beautiful melody. No matter that you now have put Deep Blue Something in my mind, I'm going to try and ignore that. And there's a sense of personal involvement about Molloy's lyrics on this song, I think through this album. That's really been missing for a while.
It's interesting because I see him more. I was a huge fan of Her Majesty, the Decemberist.
Yeah.
Do I mean Her Majesty?
That was the second album. Picaresque, I think, was the one you first went for.
And one of the things I found really striking about, that's probably my favourite album of that year. I liked it so much I can't even remember what it's called. one of the things that was sort of notable about that was he wrote sort of stories. His lyrics were like stories, sort of these visions, which not many people do nowadays, you know. And I really like that. So it's interesting he's gone for a more personal approach.
There are still some stories on the new record. I mean, there's a song about, you know, miners in Butte, Montana. But it's not all stepping away and writing generic love songs or whatever. But I think there was only so far they could pursue that line of, you know, stories about mariners and chimney sweeps and architects and legionnaires.
But they were really good.
I think he was running out of professions, though. That was the thing.
Yeah. Are you a fan as well?
Yeah,
or
I didn't really get the last album. I did persevere with it. Mm. I think that the best of is the story stuff. I absolutely loved Shankill Butchers and stuff. There's
On the Bus More. What an amazing song on
when
the Bus More.
They play a little bit with, you know, the more sinister sides of songwriting. Mm. I think they're really good because he's got such a pure and lovely voice. You know, it's quite an unusual voice, admittedly. It's kind of slightly nasal, but there's something very pure and folky about it that I've always really responded to. And when he mixes that with a bit of weirder kind of lyrical material, I think it's, you know, he really comes into his own. But I must admit, the last couple of albums, I've slipped off.
Well, I think he's definitely taking a different set of influences. It's an American music album, this one. I think it's the first really American album the Decemberists have done.
Is it American, as in kind of a more Americana feel to it?
It's just like the Gaslight Anthem most of the way.
is it American? People say it made a more American album. It's like is it like the Second Killers album?
Is it like Tupac?
It's not like that. You can hear that he's been listening to a lot of REM on it.
Right.
Okay, that's good.
Right, that's good.
Happy
that's
that.
Good. Well, look, we all like that. Next up, it's Jude's choice.
She is a stranger. You and I have history, or don't you remember? Sure, she's got it all. But baby, is that really what you want? Blessed up, so you got your head in the clouds. You made a fool.
And you said, what about Breakfast at Tiffany's? That sounds like it too. That's marvellous. That's Rumour Has It by Adele. What a great record. Jude Rogers' choice. Tell us about it, Jude.
Great, isn't it? That is the second track on Adele's forthcoming album, which is called 21.
Mm-hmm.
Last album's called 19, obviously.
Is this how old, Jude?
Yes, she's nearly 23 now. But it was written when she was 21. It's about that year of her life.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And yes, this is the second track of the album. I think it's the best track of the album. It's really fierce. It's really spiky. The first two tracks off it are really in your face. There's Rolling in the Deep, which is going to be the single, which was previewed before Christmas on various radio stations. But I think this is the best one. It starts with the most amazing drum beat, and her lyrics are very potent and full of loathing, and there's a brilliant middle eight where you realise that the things that she's saying about this bloke,
who she's named, I believe.
Yes,
I was reading in a gossip magazine. Yeah,
yes.
Yeah.
Slinky Sunbeam.
It was in Deep Blue Something, wasn't it?
Yeah. Slinky Sunbeam. No, I bet that's not his real name.
No, it's not his real name. I was trying to find his real name out today. Some guy she went out with for a while, who is probably called, you know, John Smith or something like that.
Trevor Sunbeam.
The whole album is about this, you know, fallout of this tortured relationship.
Mm.
There are a lot of ballads on it as well, but I think that she's, you know, seized the emotions that she was going through. And also this album was made With Rick Rubin at the controls.
Okay.
And it's very influenced, she says, by Americana, American stuff. Country music. She was really into Dolly Parton, Wanda Jackson. You can kind of hear a little bit of that through the album, but it is still, you know, a girl from South London who can really sing, singing about, you know, things that all us girls go through when we're 21.
I am really impressed by this. I saw Adele live, and I liked her, but I felt that her voice was disproportionately good compared to the songs she was doing. You know what I mean? I felt that the material on that first album, successful though it was, didn't match up to the sort of vocal talent that she had. This sounds great to me. This sounds like it's sort of grasping the post-Winehouse nettle a little bit, without being sort of another boring kind of Motown-y pastiche. It had real swing to it.
It had balls.
She has balls.
Well, not
Michael, you have balls.
Rumour has it the title actually refers to the place on the Radio 2 playlist, which is reserved for British Rumour. British female singers with kind of soulful voices. And Rumour now has that. I liked it too. It didn't seem post-Winehouse to me. It actually seemed more like an attempt to tap into what we might refer to as the Jack White mojo.
Yeah, maybe.
That kind of bluesy, authentic, rocky feel. I mean, it's a really exciting record, but it's a definite... Is the rest of the album changing direction like that?
No, it's not. There are lots of ballads. It really feels like she's pushing to make this absolutely massive, and good on her, you know. There's one ballad that's right at the end of it, which is probably the best... The thing that sums up the whole album, which is called Someone Like You, which she sang on later with Jules Holland. And if anybody hasn't seen that, go on to YouTube. I wanted a bit more fierceness from the album, but it is a really good, very mainstream pop album, kind of Magic FM album with some more
That's
fierce
That's no Magic
moments.
FM lady. That's not a Magic
that
FM.
Is, that
Let
is
me
by
tell
far.
You, I listen to a lot of Magic FM.
This is true.
And that, compared to what gets played on Magic FM, is like, I don't know, it's like Napalm Death.
That is by far the most fierce track on the record, right. I'll be honest. But it's not like the Rumour record at all, although I love the Rumour record because I'm my mum, basically.
Everybody loves the Rumour record, don't they?
I love her voice.
She sent me a little note.
Did she?
Yeah.
What did
amazing
it say?
Handwritten note said, thank you for your support.
Aww.
Love Rumour. Very neat handwriting, Rumour. There you go, you heard it here first. That's the piping hot news of the day. So, Michael, you dug it as well, huh?
Yeah, no, I do like that.
Excellent, excellent, excellent. Okay, lastly, it's my choice. Yeah, can somebody tell me what this is supposed to be about? Let's have a listen. And you said, what about Breakfast at Tiffany's? If only that record was as good as Breakfast at Tiffany's by Deep Blue Something. That is New Year's Day by the hotly tit band for 2011, who I only discovered yesterday. I've led a very sheltered life and hadn't come across Brother, who are... like Slough's answer to Northern Uproar, as far as I can gather. Very heavily punted by the NME. It's the Britpop revival. I can't believe there's a Britpop revival happening.
But they call it Gritpop.
Yes.
You see what they've done there?
Jesus. I'm just sort of a bit amazed by it. I suppose it points to the enormous youth of the people who are making this music in that... Jude's expression, I wish you could see. Jude looks, as my late maternal grandmother would have said, like she's lost a pound and found sixpence. What? Sweetheart. Yeah. I suppose these are really young kids for whom, you know, 1996 is a lost and halcyon era. That's all I can imagine.
Yeah, that was my era. That was my, you know, I was 18 in 1996. Or rather, I was 16 in 1994. So I was the perfect age for the Oasis
boom. The whole
boom.
Thing, yeah.
And... I think I didn't want to listen to Brother for ages because I'd seen a picture of them, which looked like a kind of Oasis parody shot taken by, you know.
They look like No Way Sis. Do you remember them?
A little bit. Or like, you know, Harry Enfield has done some skit of Oasis in 1994. But I listened to them and I heard this track as well just after New Year. And what I don't understand it at all. I'm absolutely with you. You know, when I was 16 in 1994, Oasis were very exciting. They were exciting.
Hugely, yeah.
And I know people can say, no, Oasis, you know, meat and potatoes, but they were incredibly exciting. Liam Gallagher was an incredibly good-looking, incredibly charismatic frontman, great voice, still has a great voice, still charismatic, even though he hasn't made, well, until BDI, who I quite like.
I quite like that BDI.
You know, they put something new and fresh about them, and they were exciting. And what's weird about this track is it's got, it sounds a bit more like Blur, actually, that those uh-oh sounds, and a bit like King Adorah. But they're not even a Britpop revival band, are they? Or Gritpop, whatever. It's like the tail end of all the terrible stuff that came out in the wake of Britpop, which I also remember.
I think that's the thing, is it's not that it sounds like Oasis at all, because the great thing about Oasis's first album, and indeed it was always true of Oasis live throughout their career, no matter how boring their records got, was this sort of huge wall of guitars that was obviously derived from the way Nevermind the Bollocks was produced. And that was hugely exciting on their first album, was always made them an exciting band live if on a night, you know, when on a good night. And this doesn't seem to have that at all. It sounds really weedy. Michael.
Now, I speak as probably the person in this room with the greatest exposure to and knowledge of Brother, perhaps in the country, in fact, having actually seen them, met them, lived the Brother life.
You are too. You are now, you're the John Harris of Britpop.
The problem with them is that they're not that good. There's no real getting around that. But what's intriguing about them is the wave of hate. I've heard a lot of people talking about them, and every single person I've spoken to despises them. Yet they got a deal with Geffen for what's believed to be 150,000 quid. They got picked up by EMI Publishing. I saw them playing the Met Bar, a gig that was picked for its resonance with fag end of Britpop late 90s. Not a good gig. Afterwards, a load of us out on the street outside having an argument about this, and the guy who signed to the publishing saying, "You lot don't understand. You lot who live in the metropolis and you like your XX, this is a band who kids in Middlesbrough are going to like." Now, I don't know if that's intensely patronising towards kids in Middlesbrough. I don't know, the guy was from Middlesbrough. Or if it just suggests that we really have no understanding of what is actually popular with people. I mean, the great post-Oasis critical dissension, where we suddenly realise that critics were wildly out of touch. But the thing that gets on my nerves about them is there's a lack of truth about it. I don't think they're cynical. I think they're young kids. They say things that they think interviewers want to hear, but it comes out all wrong. So I spoke to them, I interviewed them in the pub I used to drink in as a teenager in Slough. I went to meet them largely, to be honest, because they were from Slough and they support QPR, which is traits I have in common. And we were talking about new music, and they were saying how much they love Kings of Leon. Great band. If we could be like them, it would be amazing. And then their enemy interview this week, "We hate Kings of Leon, terrible band." You know, they're thinking of the things they want to, so they think interviewers want to hear.
Do you think the enemy are rallying behind them because they're, you know, a band of blokes with guitars?
Behind them for two reasons. And the enemy really could use a big crossover success from their world that crosses over in a way beyond something like the XX crossing over. It would do the enemy good.
Who they wouldn't put on the cover for a long time because they look a bit funny.
Yeah, absolutely. And also, you know, the XX are going to cross over. It would be good for the enemy to have a big sort of, you know, band that does sort of hugely well and massively successful in the charts, because nothing has come out of indie music, really, or sort of certainly the area of indie music the enemy own, i.e. not the Kings of Leon, since the Kaiser Chiefs. You know?
I don't think it's just about that. The industry had decided 3 or 4 months ago that something was going to happen with Brother.
I've got to be honest with you. I'm fully prepared to come on here in 6 months' time and say I was wrong. I don't think this is going to take off. I don't think this is going to fly.
We'll see. I've heard a few songs of theirs, and there is a spark about them as people. There's a kind of charisma about the singer, Lee. But, they keep saying the things like, "Well, we went away and wrote some songs and discovered we've written the best songs in 20 years. Sorry, lads, if you say that kind of stuff, you have to back it up."
Yeah.
If you were a bit more modest about your ambitions, I don't think people would be pouring on the derision quite as much as they are.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, in a way, you know, they are sort of making a difficult furrow for themselves because they're playing really unfashionable music on one level. Mm. Now is not the time to be coming sounding like a Britpop band. Maybe it is. Maybe we're all wrong. Who knows? Right, that's enough judgment for now. Listeners, tell us what you think at guardian.co.uk/music. How about a bit of Micro House?
What?
Don't all rush at once.
I don't know what is micro house. I like that.
Terraced
house is really, really small ones. Okay. Two up, two downs.
I live in one of them.
Yeah. A micro house. Well, listen, you don't know what micro house is? Listen and learn. Listen and learn, Jude. We've got a quick profile of the Cologne-based electronic music imprint Compact, which has released music from The Field, Super Pitcher, The Orb, and others. We talked to co-owner Michael Mayer, down the line from Germany. He told us about Compact's particular recipe of techno and how the label got started.
Hello, this is Michael Mayer from Compact Records in Cologne. I'm mostly taking care here of the A&R-ing of the label. I'm also recording artists on the label. And I'm something like the ambassador of the label. Compact developed out of a local record store here, which fortunately still exists. This record shop was always the basis, the social meeting point for the Cologne scene. Like, there was throughout the 90s there was a very thriving scene of electronic music in Cologne. Lots of producers, small labels popping up like mushrooms, and Compact, the record shop, served as a meeting point, and from 1998 on as well as a distribution hub for all these labels. Compact is still a distribution company as well. Like, we're taking care of around about 60 labels from all over the world, and we try to make sure that this music can be heard in all over the world. Compact's releasing like anything between experimental ambient to hard banging techno or gay disco. So there's not really one common denominator, but accept the taste of the people behind the label and our attitude, which is like anything goes as long as we like it and as entertaining us. Our most successful recording artist so far, I think, is Gui Barreto from Sao Paulo in Brazil. He had a phenomenal career. He did his first record with us in 2004. At that time, no one knew him or his music, and he crossed over into the dance mainstream somehow, unintentionally, which is always a nice thing when that happens. Signed a new project from Copenhagen. They're called Chatoma. Incredibly weird but catchy music. It's three guys. Two of them are below 20 years old, but their music sounds so wise and so experienced and so psychedelic. It's really stunning how these super young guys are able to come up with mature music like this. We're going to release an album with them this November. Compact always had a very strong base here in Germany, which might also be due to the fact that we here and then release records containing German lyrics. Like, the German language was always something we embraced, as opposed to many other labels in the electronic or in the techno world that tried to sound as American or as international as possible. For us, it was always important to show our roots and to not try to be someone else, you know.
Right, there you go. That was Compaq's Michael Meyer talking to us from Cologne. I think it's probably fair to say that just calling the output of Compaq Micro House is perhaps a little bit reductive. Judy, you're a fan of this label?
Yes, I am a fan of this label. I'm a fan of any music that sounds like it was made by robots, basically.
Right.
Which I know is a ridiculously...
No, I totally...
I don't know, I've kind of... I really like their compilations. I haven't... I've said this before on a podcast. I'm an indie girl who went a bit electronic in my early 20s.
Right.
And became a ridiculous Kraftwerk obsessive.
Right.
You know, wanted to go to Dusseldorf and find
Kling Klang. Don't go to Dusseldorf.
Yeah, I know, I was told
like
not to go.
Like Leicester.
Oh, we've talked about this before, haven't we? Because yeah. Kraftwerk's accents in Germany sound like the Brummy accents.
Well, no,
like
that's
that.
What somebody told me.
Okay.
And I've never been able to verify that. It would be amazing if Kraftwerk had Brummy accents.
It would.
What would the operator with the pocket calculator? Amazing.
No, I'm always interested in... I love a lot of stuff that's come out of Germany in the last 30, 40 years. I'm a bit of a krautrock nerd.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm a bit of a German techno nerd. I'm not a clubber in any sense. I'm somebody who sits at home and listens to techno while she's doing the dishes. But yeah, I think I found it really interesting what you were saying about, you know, addressing the German roots of their music, because a lot of bands don't, and Kraftwerk were probably the first band that actually addressed certain parts of German's history, Germany's history, you know, the kind of less pleasant elements of its history.
Rammstein, they've addressed.
Yeah, well, Rammstein is slightly different, aren't they, let's be honest. Yeah, some of that stuff sounds really lovely.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that he said that a lot of techno artists in Germany sort of try to appear American or something like that, because to my mind, obviously techno comes from America and comes from Detroit.
Yes.
It seems really odd, because I always thought of techno, particularly in the 90s, as kind of quite a German, quite a sort of Germanic
Detroit
phenomenon,
techno,
you know.
You know, the thing that fueled it completely was the sounds
of Kraftwerk,
Middle Europe.
Yeah, although I'll tell you what, some of those people, those techno producers in Detroit, they stuff they like, absolutely off the map. It's sort of told them, yeah, man, Culture Club. It's just, you know, like basically early 80s, anything vaguely early 80s and electronic. It's an intriguing label, Compaq. Michael, have you got anything to add on the subject of Compaq? Don't strike me as one of life's natural...
My opinions on Compaq will be about as useful as your opinions on the direction and change that Judas Priest undertook between Sad Wings of Destiny and British Steel.
And you said, what about Breakfast at Tiffany's? Thank you all very much. I actually know a bit about... I tell you what... Don't come that with me, because I watched classic albums, British Steel,
British Steel.
Sky Arts the other week.
British Steel is brilliant. I heard that for the first time last year. It's really good.
It was absolutely amazing. My wife stayed up and watched it, which I've never watched.
Priest are an amazing group, properly amazing group. One of my favourite ever live bands.
Wow.
Best tribute band ever as well. Judas Priest's tribute band called Judith Priest.
Wow, that's brilliant.
Good, isn't it?
All female. Judith.
Sadly not, but that would be good. Maybe I should start one up. I'm a Judith. That'd be amazing.
Actually, the drummer out of Dodgy should form his own, shouldn't he? Matthew Judas Priest.
There's a Bon Jovi tribute band called Bi Jovi. Anyway, on that brilliant note, thank you all very much for coming in. My thanks to Michael Hamm.
Thank you, Alexis.
Thank you, as ever. Lovely to see you, Jude.
Thank you.
Thanks to our producer, Pascal Wise. I'm Alexis Petridis. Join us again next week.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.